Well, this week we come to study number 5 in our series of Journey Through the Bible. And last week we covered, by way of introduction, the book of Genesis. And this week we come to the book of Exodus. Now, as I mentioned last week, what I plan to do in these teaching sessions is not to give a detailed exegesis of the content or even the primary content of the books, but to cover roughly one book a week, giving primarily an introduction by way of literary overview. And my purpose of all of this is to prepare you to read the Bible for yourselves. And so let's first of all consider in this study, Journey Through Exodus, a bit of a literary overview and introduction. As we read the book of Exodus, how should we approach it? What are the things that we should keep our eyes open for? Well, first of all, as we touched on last week, the primary author or compiler of the book of Exodus is attributed traditionally and also in Scripture to Moses the prophet, who becomes a major feature and character within this book. So Moses is the primary writer or author. The primary audience is the nation of Israel, though it, of course, we are a secondary audience. It was primarily written for Israel as they prepared to go into the Promised Land and telling them what they needed to know as they entered in. Now, the purpose, the literary purpose of the book of Exodus is to record the historical events of the deliverance of Israel and to give the original content of God's requirements to them, His own law. This becomes the great redemptive story, which is celebrated and remembered by the nation in many years to come. Now, the historical event is later seen as a shadow or type of the New Covenant, something we'll come to later, of New Covenant redemption, and Moses is a prototype of the Lord Jesus as the great prophet. So the purpose is to record these events and to give them an understanding of how they got where they were as a nation. Now, here's some of the plot line or the main story. In Exodus, Israel is delivered from their slavery and suffering in Egypt under a human king through the man, the prophet Moses. They are taken to Mount Sinai, where they receive the law of God, which will direct their new way of life in service to the Lord God. The main purpose of all of this redemption is the glory of God itself. That's something of the plot line, the redemption and the taking of God to himself, a people, to be his own special nation. Now, the main events in the book of Exodus include the calling of Moses, the plagues, the well-known plagues, the escape from Egypt, the rescue through the Red Sea, and also their receiving of the law at Mount Sinai. Those are some of the main events. And as far as the main characters, the primary protagonist or character in the book of Exodus is, of course, God himself as the great deliverer, the great redeemer. But then also we have this dual character in this fight between Moses and Pharaoh that takes up a good portion of the book. Those are some of the main characters. There are secondary characters, which include men like Aaron, women like Miriam, but those are some of the main characters. Now, as far as the book of Exodus's form or genre, what kind of literature it is, from chapter 1 through 19, it's primarily narrative. There's a little bit of narrative after that part, but secondarily. And then there's this shift to civil law code, how they're to live as a new nation, redeemed of the Lord, and also a great bit of detail and regulation for worship, which brings us last under this heading, the challenges. Here are some of the challenges of reading the book of Exodus. First of all, there is this change from exciting and moving narrative to law codes and regulations. From chapter 19 to chapter 20, it's almost like you hit a brick wall. In chapter 1 through 19, you have the exciting raising up of Moses as the prophet, how he goes into the wilderness, how he comes back, the cycle of 10 plagues, the rescue from the Dead Sea. They're going to Mount Sinai through the wilderness, the provision of manna, the provision of water, the provision of all these things. And then chapter 20 comes in. It's like you hit this as far as story and movement, this brick wall, and then it's just saturated with law. Here's what you should do in this case. This is what you should do in this case. And then it follows up with the instructions for the tabernacle, the details of what kind of clothes they're to wear in the sacrifices, the details of what kind of sacrifices they're to have, how to mix up the incense. And so as far as reading, it's a lot easier to read Exodus 1 through 19 and even moving into 20 with the Ten Commandments. But then after that, it gets almost completely bogged down to the reader by way of these law codes. So that's one of the challenges. The second challenge, I think, is learning what and how to apply of these laws given to Israel. as we read through them, one of the major questions is, how do these things apply to us? We know that the sacrifices don't directly apply to us. We don't have to have these specific animals or these wheat offerings. We don't have to build the tabernacle or our new building exactly after the pattern of the tabernacle. But then the question arises, what do we make of those things? Because as you read along, there's some things that are clearly applicable to us, more moral issues, such as the forbidding of incest, such as the forbidding of homosexuality, such as the forbidding of doing certain kinds of things and the abuse of servants or of slaves or of parents to children relationship. A lot of that is clearly pertinent and applicatory to us. But what do we do with a lot of these other things becomes the question. Do we ignore them? Do we apply them in a secondary way? And we'll come to try to look at that later. But at this point, I'll just point out that when it comes to the New Testament, there is a frequent referral to what is found in chapter 20, what is called the Decalogue or the Ten Commandments. What we find in the New Testament is not this new law code that suddenly is raised, but there's a continual reference to the Ten Commandments as obligatory, as pertinent, and applicatory to the life of the New Covenant believer. And we'll come to that later. So a third challenge is responding to the attacks of skeptics on the book of Exodus. Because here are found some of the greatest miraculous historical events in the Old Testament, including the plagues and especially the parting and moving through the Red Sea. One of the difficulties in this is recognizing that God is doing miracles, but he's often doing those miracles using some natural connections, some things in nature itself. When we get to the Red Sea parting, we're told that God sent an east wind and blew on the water all night, all day, so that the waters parted. So you could do a scientific experiment of that moment and say, well, the waters parted because there was an eastern wind. And there's true. God is using nature in that. There's been some questions raised about the plagues of the frogs and the other things and saying, well, those are just things that frequently happened in that land. Well, that might be true, and there might be some connection to that, but there's also the identification of those things in their timing and in how God used them as also miraculous and become a picture of his redemption. So responding to the attacks of the critics and trying to work through this connection between miraculous events and their natural connections. So let's move on to the next section, and I've got a lot of material, that's why I'm moving fairly rapidly here, which is really an outline of the content of the book, and you'll see I've broken it up into two primary phases. Phase one is the deliverance of Israel, and phase two is the establishment of Israel as a nation. First of all, phase one, the deliverance of Israel. In chapter 1, 1 through 22, we see the need for a deliverer. The people of Israel, that is Jacob and his sons, come into Egypt with about 70 people with them due to the mercy of Joseph and Pharaoh to save them from the famine. While there, they increase greatly in numbers so that a later Pharaoh begins to fear them that they will rebel and fight against them. From a group of about 70 people coming into Egypt, multiplying greatly, as we'll see, and the Pharaoh begins to fear and says, they're so spread out, there's so many among us that I'm afraid that if they join our enemies, we're in big trouble. This is like, you know, some of the concern we have in America with the cells, the secret cells of Muslims. We think, oh, what's going to happen if suddenly they rise up against us? Are there all these secret cells taking place? Well, Pharaoh had that same concern. Are all these Jews at some point going to overthrow us? So in response to this, this fear, the king establishes laws over time that make the Jews slaves, because they don't come into Egypt as slaves. But eventually laws and practices begin to take place that make the Jews slaves and gives them the task of building the mighty buildings of that age, which some scholars think perhaps even the pyramids were at least partly built by the Jewish people. Now, when we keep in mind all of Old Testament history, this issue of their coming into slavery in a foreign land should strike us as a bit odd. This is the only instance that I'm aware of where this kind of oppression, we're going to see it's a severe oppression, it's not connected with Israel's disobedience. Remember when they go into Assyria, when they go into Babylon, it's because God's chastisement of them. They're doing the wrong thing. They're not obeying his laws. They're not keeping those laws. And he says, I will chastise you by sending you out and dispersing you into all the nations. That doesn't happen in this account. As a matter of fact, it's in the face of Abraham's the promises made to Abraham of God blessing them and showing great mercy to them. But this is not something that in the flow of the story is really surprising. You'll remember back in Genesis 15 and verse 13, God says to Abraham, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years." So in the flow of the story, you already know if you've read Genesis that this is going to happen. And so when you come to Exodus, you don't scratch your head and say, "How in the world did this happen?" God has already said that this was going to take place. Now, as we think about God's plan and God's purposes, His putting His people in order to bless them into slavery seems odd or even inefficient at first. If you were going to prosper and bless somebody, would you first put them under horrible, oppressive slavery? Well, that wouldn't be our most efficient means as we would think of it. But God has a purpose in this, as we see in Genesis 15, 14. He says, "Also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions." God planned for this to happen for specific purposes. As in many things in our life, many things that happen when we're younger, in the background, at the backdrop of our life, we don't see how that works into God's plan. But what we see here is an example of incredible difficulty designed by the Lord to display His glory. And I think we can learn a lot from that. Even as Joseph went into slavery in Egypt so that God would exalt him and show His glory in him, what happened with Joseph in a smaller scale now happens to the entire nation, not because of their sin, but for the glory of God. And so we should take that to heart and recognize that even our difficulties, even the things that we don't understand in our life, as we'll see the severe slavery and even murder of thousands of babies, even that was used ultimately for God's glory. Now, this slavery then continues for some 400 years. And to put that in historical perspective, if we go back to 1776, we've only been in existence for 232 years. So they were in Egyptian bondage for over 400 years, or around 400 years. Generations during those four centuries would come and go. Surely during this time there were people who remembered God's promises to Abraham and said, "Lord, why is this going on? What have we done?" And God seems to be for 400 years silent, for almost twice as long as we've been a nation. Surely there were people who remembered the promises given to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. Surely there were those godly people who were praying for mercy, yet the suffering continued, the great suffering. Now, the oppression of the Hebrews didn't seem to be working. Pharaoh's plan was, well, I will cause them to suffer. I will put them in slavery. That will be a kind of control over them. But after some time, he realizes that this wasn't working. In verse 12, we are told, "The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad." That could also be written about the Christian church, by the way. But that is the case, that he was trying this, and it was just simply not working. The people continued to spread and continued to multiply. How much did they multiply? Well, by the time of the Exodus, we're told that there are about 600,000 men, not including women and children. So from about 70 people coming in from the 12 sons coming in with Joseph, to the time of the Exodus, 400 years, there are over 600,000, probably close to 1 million people will be coming out of Egypt. Try to sustain that movement of people out into a wilderness. An amazing thing. And we're told that, by the way, in chapter 12, verse 37. So since this isn't working and they're spreading so much, Pharaoh devises another and even more evil plan. He commands that the midwives, Shiphrah and Puah, who help deliver the children, are possibly the head midwives over a team of midwives, possibly, he instructs them to, when they deliver the children, when the children come out, if they see it's a boy, strangle it or kill it as it's coming out of the womb, and then say, "Well, we don't understand. The baby just died somehow." So these two women, Shiphrah and Puah, are commanded by the most powerful man in all of the known world at that point, especially in Egypt, This is what I command you to do, to kill these Hebrew boys as an effort of population control. Now, out of the fear of God, these two women disobey the king, and the people continue to flourish, and God gives those women their own families as a blessing. We're told that explicitly in the text. Note that while the specific name of the Pharaoh and Pharaohs of Exodus are never mentioned, these two women's names are preserved forever. I mean, we would be very, and the scholars go back and forth, what particular pharaohs are these talking about? But their name is blotted out of the Word of God. The pharaohs, these greatest men in the earth with all of the power, we don't even know their names. But here are these two God-fearing, God-obeying women that God blesses, and we still have their names. The only time they're mentioned in the Bible. God measures greatness in a very different way than what the kingdoms of men do. Now, the violence at this point escalates. The women say, and they lie, or perhaps taking their time to get to the women, these babies are born, it's too late, we can't get there. So the violence escalates. And now what Pharaoh tries is to secretly becomes a social edict or a social command. He now commands all of the Egyptian people, all of the Egyptian citizens, when you see a Jewish boy, throw him into the Nile. When you see a young boy, the Hebrews are walking around, you see one of them come out with a baby, you take that baby and you throw that baby into the river. It's now escalated to the point of he will not be concerned at all about what they think. He tries to do it secretly and he says, cast them into the river so that they would die. Now it becomes very explicit, his murderous heart. Imagine the overall atmosphere of living in such a culture where your people were hated that much that when you walked out the door with your boy child, you knew that you were not going to come home with them. That is the culture and the degree of oppression that the Jewish people are crying out, how long, O Lord? How long? And your Egyptian neighbors and your Egyptian taskmasters and everybody who has any control of your life takes up the task of killing your male children for a means of population control. And yet the people continue to cry out, how long, O Lord? Even as we'll see in a moment, Moses is raised up for about 40 years in Egypt, and that doesn't change. He goes 40 years in the wilderness as God prepares him to be the deliverer, and there's no change. Hundreds and thousands of baby boys, young men, would have been killed through this means during that time. That's something of the need for a deliverer as Israel comes into Egypt. Now, second, notice the preparation of a deliverer. We read this beginning in chapter 2. First of all, the birth and deliverance of Moses. In this setting, there's an incredible piece of narrative irony. We get to learn something that Pharaoh doesn't get to know for about 40 years or so, or doesn't realize. In this setting, a most ironic event takes place. As Pharaoh is attempting to oppress and keep the Israelites in bondage, his own household becomes the refuge for the man who will deliver them. That's narrative, that's irony. Here he is doing everything he can, trying to get everybody, and probably because of his love for his daughter and the influence of a daughter over a man's heart, is probably the reason, and what God uses to make that home the refuge of the very one that will deliver this people and even be the death of the later Pharaoh's firstborn son. We know the story well of a Hebrew woman who sends her infant child with his sister to the Nile River and sets him in a waterproof basket. Pharaoh's own daughter spots the child floating and sends her servant to fetch him. After returning him to his grandmother to be nursed, or to his mother to be nursed, he's eventually brought into Pharaoh's household and adopted as that daughter's son. In other words, he becomes the legal grandson of Pharaoh. That we are so familiar with that. But isn't that amazing? He is doing everything he can and spilling much blood. And now, this man becomes his grandson, legally. In that household, Moses receives the finest training available that will equip him to be the leader of a million people. We are told in Acts 7:21 that he was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was mighty in words and deeds. There, raised in a place of affluence, is Moses, who will be the deliverer. Now notice secondly, under this heading, letter B, his flight into the wilderness. Chapter 2, verse 11 through 25. Like the life of Christ, there is very little else that we are told about Moses during these years of his childhood. As a matter of fact, he's seen suddenly grown up in verse 11, and he's 40 years old, even older than when Christ comes onto the scene at around 30. We can only imagine the details of his life at this place. We just simply don't have any information. There are some Jewish traditions that we could perhaps take into account, but scripturally we don't know anything for sure. We can ask questions like, when did he realize he was Jewish? Did he realize he was Jewish? At what point? Was it after he tried to deliver the Jewish slave? Was he told later? Did his mom come and visit him? How did Pharaoh tolerate him in the household? Did Pharaoh know from the beginning he was a Jewish boy? How in the world did he tolerate the ones he hated so much, one of the very children in his household? As I mentioned earlier, probably the influence of a daughter on a father's heart has something to do with this. Dad, I found this baby, and I don't have any children. I found it, but he's a Jewish boy. But Dad, okay, you can keep him. There's the deliverer. We don't know exactly, but was it something like that? Perhaps. Did he have a sense, that is, did Moses have a sense in the incident with the Egyptian and the slave that he was called to enact justice for God's people? Or was this his own attempt at beginning such a deliverance? We simply don't know. We're not told, we can only speculate. But what we do know is that he responds to a situation involving the beating of a Jewish slave when it says he goes out to his people. He tries to secretly kill the Egyptian. It says it's a very lively scene. He looks to and fro. He's looking. He intends to kill this guy. And he's looking around to see if there are going to be any witnesses. And there is the Jewish servant beat to a pulp by this man. And he looks around, makes sure nobody is looking, and kills him and hides him in the sand. There's your deliverer. There's the one God is raising up to lead out his people. So he responds in that situation and beats up this, or kills this Egyptian, probably taskmaster, tries to hide his body in the sand. But this doesn't go as he had hoped, and he is sentenced to death by Pharaoh. Pharaoh finds out, and that is either the final straw, or that's the straw, or that's the thing that he then puts a death sentence on him. And he proclaims throughout the land, Moses, this man, my grandson, must die. And so Moses responds to that by fleeing to the land of Midian. Midian was the son of Abraham by his concubine Keturah, and Midian had four sons, and their land stretched from, if you think about the Mediterranean Sea, and here's the Sea of Galilee, there's the Dead Sea, here's the Sinai Peninsula that comes down like that, and here's Egypt with the Nile. And the region of Midian stretched, these four sons, from here all the way down into the Sinai Peninsula. And it's probably as he flees then across the Red Sea, goes down, Mount Sinai is going to be down here. Somewhere in this wilderness is where he flees to. He gets far away from Egypt. So he flees to the land of Midian. Find my place here again. Okay, and it is there in Midian that Moses is received into the people of Jethro, a child of Midian, or a descendant of Midian, in response to his kindness to Jethro's daughters. At that point, he's married. How old is he? 40. All right, you younger guys, don't worry. You younger ladies, don't worry. He's 40 years old, goes into the wilderness. Of course, he lived to be 120. But nevertheless, is married, from what we know, the first time at the age of 40. He then settles in there for another 40 years and helps tend Jethro's flock. And when we come to the issue, the timing of the burning bush, he is about 80 years old. Okay? A lot could be said about that. But during this period, Pharaoh dies, that Pharaoh that he was dealing with, and the people of Israel continue to cry out for God, to God for rescue. God hears their groaning, but still doesn't do anything for another 40 years while Moses is just tending sheep on the side of a mountain. Where is God in the midst of all of this? Now we come third and last under this heading, letter C, his call from God, chapter 3, verse 1 to the end of chapter 4. After those 40 years, Moses is tending the flock of his father-in-law when the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob appears to him in a theophany. A theophany is the appearance of the invisible God in some visible form. It's not just a human form, but some visible form. In this case, a burning bush. The fire does not consume that bush. He tells Moses that he has heard the groans of his people, about 400 years at this point, 400 moving on the far end of that. And he tells Moses that he will be the one who will be the human instrument to confront Pharaoh and deliver the people from their slavery. Moses initially objects, but finally succumbs to the Lord's call. Aaron is also called as the mouthpiece of Moses, and we know the problem that Moses felt like he was not eloquent enough to do that. God compromises, or at least negotiates with Moses and agrees to let Aaron be his mouthpiece. And so Moses then returns to Egypt at somewhere around 80 years old, has a council with the elders of the people. Now, try to picture that. Moses was raised 40 years and was known as the child, the grandson of Pharaoh. They hear that he's killed an Egyptian and flees. And he's been gone for 40 years. And he probably looks different than he did when he was 40. Most of us look different, a little bit different between 40 and 80. He comes back, says, I've been out in the wilderness for 40 years. God appeared to me in a burning bush, and I need to go talk to Pharaoh, and I need your guys' support for this, because God's going to deliver us. If you were the elders of Israel, what would you think? I mean, you picture Moses as, you know, the big beard. We don't know if he had a big beard or not, but the big beard, bushy hair guy that comes out from the wilderness and says, I'm the prophet that's going to deliver God's people. Well, where have you been? You know, what is going on? Probably that was an initially interesting meeting. Well, he comes back, he meets with them, and somehow he rallies them to his support. For a while. So he comes back, rallies their support, and he begins the work of the engagement with the king of the Egyptians, Pharaoh himself. Which brings us to the third and last section under this, the work of the deliverer. First of all, in chapter 5, we read of the initial failure. Things don't go as well as he had hoped again. Things do not start out smoothly, and the initial encounter only makes Pharaoh perturbed and angry at them. He says, you know why you're talking about going out in the wilderness? You know why? You know what the real problem is here? It's not that your God has called you to worship, but you've got too much free time on your hands. And because you've got too much free time on your hands, you're worried about worship and serving your God. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to take away a main part of what you need in order to build these bricks for me. And I'm going to stop supplying you with that so you'll use up that extra time doing my work. We'll see if that helps a little bit. So sure enough, they are beating the tar out of the slaves. And the slaves say, why are you doing this? We're having to work harder, longer. You've not lowered our quota at all. Why is this? And Pharaoh says, it's Moses. You guys got too much time on your hands. And so how do the people and how do the elders respond? Thanks a lot, Moses, Mr. Deliverer. This is great. My wife got the tar beat out of her today because of you. I had to work even longer hours today. And we are oppressed. Thanks a lot. And they turn on him. They said, you have put a sword in Pharaoh's hand. You've put a death sentence on us. This is going to kill us. And how does Moses respond to that? Moses turns and speaks to God asking, why have you done this? Why have you done this? He says plainly to him, you have not delivered your people at all. What's going on here? But this isn't a surprise to God, and he has already told Moses this was going to happen. He says, you will go to Pharaoh, and he won't hear you. I will harden his heart, that my glory might be displayed in him. He says, Pharaoh will not listen, for he will harden his heart, and will not let the people go. So the initial failure shouldn't have been a surprise. Well, then begins in chapter 6 what I'm calling the painful process. And if you read through carefully at the plagues, I mean, we're so familiar with them. We think of Moses and Charlton Heston and that kind of thing. You know, it just kind of passes by us. But this is the equivalent of a horror story. I mean, there is some really creepy and awful things going on through this section. I mean, if you picture it, it is awful what is taking place. After this apparent failure, God affirms what He's going to do. He says, I am going to deliver you from the hand of Pharaoh. And He sends Moses and Aaron again into the presence of Pharaoh. Thus begins the cycle of plagues that afflict the land and eventually hones in on just the Egyptians. There's some reason to indicate that some of the earlier plagues afflicted everybody, but then it begins to hone in down on the Egyptians specifically, which shows it's more than natural events, even if God is using natural means because of their honing in only on the Egyptians. So this begins the cycle. The plagues include the turning of water into blood. Not only the water of the Nile, but the water in the water pots and in the wells. And that, I don't understand how that could be naturally connected to anything, unless everything died and it all bled out and there was blood everywhere. But a very unusual thing happens here. Turns water, and this is really important in the Nile region, where water was considered itself, and the Nile was considered a god of sorts. This is what gives us life. Without the Nile and without water, this place is a desert. And the green, most lush places and the several kingdoms that begin to build up and down the Nile all were centered around the water and the issue of the water. And you could look at a geographic map of that area at that time, and you would see green lush moving out however far from the Nile. And it was in those areas that these first tribes would come in, begin to build up the nation of Egypt. And so when the water is turned to blood, they strike at the very life source of this entire nation. That's the first. And awful. I mean, can you imagine pulling your pitcher out of the refrigerator and it's blood? You turn on your water faucet. They don't have refrigerators, faucets, but you get the idea. Turn on your faucet and blood comes out. And this is awful. I mean, you think horror films are bad. This is awful. But it doesn't end there. Then the deluge of frogs. And not just a few frogs, but a deluge of frogs. Frogs everywhere. Everywhere you step, you're hearing the crunching and the squishing of frogs. Isn't that gross? But that's what they're dealing with. It's in their food. It's in their clothes. It's on their children when they try to put them down to sleep. Frogs, they come back, are all over them. This is awful. How about the third? The deluge of gnats. You ever seen a horse with lots of horse flies, how it's constantly swatting? Imagine being covered incessantly with gnats. No matter how much you swat, no matter how much they bite at your skin, this moment you swat, they're right back on you. That's what's going on here. The deluge of flies. The fifth, the death of livestock. We don't live, most of us, with livestock. But imagine if your food didn't come from Walmart, Super Walmart, Kroger, Publix, or any of those places. But when you looked out into the field and saw Bessie, that's our food. And now Bessie's dead and rotting in the field. You don't say, I guess we'll have to go to Plan B. We'll have to import some food. It didn't happen. So massive amounts of livestock. Number six, affliction of boils on people and the animals. Think of Job spread out among an entire nation. I mean, some of us get worried over zits. Imagine being covered with boils. Very painful. Number seven, a barrage of hail that kills people and destroys crops. We saw some hail. Some of us saw hail the other night. Imagine hail so large, you're standing out in the middle of it, you're dead. It's like boulders falling on you and crushing your skull. And they say, get all of your servants, get all of your livestock out of the field, get them in shelter. Imagine the insurance policies you'd have to carry for that. I mean, just stuff destroyed. Then number eight, an attack of locusts which finish off whatever is left of the budding crops that was not wiped out by the hail itself. While we are told the details, while we're not told the details, it is likely that these various judgments are actually judgments on the variety of Egyptian gods. And some scholars have done a lot of work to try to show how each of these judgments are particularly connected to some of the panacea of Egyptian gods. And that might be the case. We're not told the specifics, but probably it's something like that. God saying, I am the one who's in control of your land, and you as a pagan nation, I'm in control of everything that gives you life and sustains you, and your gods are nothing. It's a judgment on the gods themselves. Now, through these plagues, there are cycles of responses from Pharaoh, which include refusal, I will not let you go, to affliction, to him pleading, please tell your God to stop this. Negotiation, okay, look, just you go out. Don't take your children, don't take your, you just go. He tries to negotiate at various points. Promises, okay, if you back off, I'll let you go. But then after the promises, failures to keep those promises. Ultimately, Pharaoh again and again, as devastating as this sounds, refuses. Now, probably his popularity ratings at the polls at this point aren't very good, but he's Pharaoh. You can't vote him out. I mean, maybe you can kill him, put somebody else, but he's a god too, so that's gonna turn bad for you in the view of the Egyptian. Through these plagues, there's the cycle of responses, and there's a dual theme of Pharaoh hardening his heart as well as God hardening Pharaoh's heart. And you see that cycle. So who is hardening Pharaoh's heart? Pharaoh or God? Both. That's what we're told in the text. But the Lord isn't done after the ninth plague and has designed one last devastating judgment on the Egyptians. And again, in the mystery of the Lord, why didn't he just do this one first? Well, part of it was probably he was demonstrating his superiority over all of the Egyptian gods. One last devastating judgment, the plague of the firstborn in all of Egypt. And for this, he will send a supernatural means, clearly an angel who becomes the angel of death. All of the firstborn, all of the first ones who open the womb of animal or of people will die on this horrible, horrible night. When this happens, it's told there was not a household in which there was not wailing over the death of the firstborn. It doesn't mean just babies. It means if you got a 13-year-old, if the firstborn of the household in a conglomerate household is 40, he's dead. So don't just think children. Think of all different ages, whoever the firstborn were of each of the wombs. A massive amount of people are killed in a night. In conjunction with this night of horror, God gives a ritual meal that will be repeated by the Jews through the ages, will be a means of their deliverance as well as remembrance of God's care and protection, this meal called the Passover. The terrifying night comes and the firstborn of every family mysteriously dies as the angel of the Lord moves through the land. He passes over the Jewish homes where the blood of the sacrificial lamb has been smeared on the thresholds of the homes. Kill the lamb, drain its blood, smear it on the threshold, the opening entrance of your home. The angel comes by, and because of the blood of the lamb, the angel passes over. But everywhere there was not the blood of the lamb, the angel goes in, searches out the firstborn, and kills him or her on the spot. Pharaoh finally gives in at the loss of his firstborn son. The Egyptian people say, it is enough. They send out the slaves, and they don't only send them out, but they say, we want to make sure you have everything you need so you don't come back. So they plunder the Egyptians, not by fighting the Egyptians and stealing their stuff, but the Egyptians are so devastated, they are giving them gold and silver and clothes and tapestry. They are emptying out their treasuries to give to the Egyptian people, which becomes very important because he will use that same material and gold and silver and idols to melt down and to build his place of worship, the tabernacle. And all of the tapestries, they didn't have the means of things to create all of what they needed. Much of what they had would be taken from Egypt itself. So they give in. God appears in a cloud and a pillar of fire to lead them out where he wants them to go. Which brings us Last under this heading, the Red Sea, chapter 14 through 15, at least 15:21. Well, just when you thought things were going well, it turns again. Pharaoh says, "What have I done? I just emptied out the entire land of our slave workforce." His whole manual labor workforce, he is just allowed to leave. And he decides to either pursue them and kill them or to pursue them to bring them back. This brings us to the confrontation of the Red Sea, where God sends a wind to part the waters while his presence in the fire keeps Pharaoh's army and his 900, I believe it was, chariots. And people on foot, horse-driven chariots are like tanks that will completely just devastate, roll over you and kill you. I mean, they could kill hundreds of thousands of people just with their chariots. Moses and his people, by the miraculous work of God, move through, pass through the middle of the sea. When Pharaoh's army tries the same waters, tries to cross, the waters return and the entire Egyptian army and that Pharaoh are destroyed. We're told in a quite vivid verse, in verse 30 of that chapter, Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. I mean, imagine watching those thousands of men die, swallowed up and drowning in the water. And then you stand there long enough to see their bodies and their, probably, well, not their swords, those would have sunk, but whatever they had of wood or anything that would float, floating up dead bodies onto the shore. And what happens? We had the first musical in the Bible. They respond to that with Moses' song. This lengthy song praising the Lord for his destruction of his enemies. Then what happens? Moses' sister Miriam and a group of dancing and singing women with tambourines dance around and celebrate the victory of God. You say, that seems pretty morbid. But think of what they've been through. And think of the movement of God's hand in delivering them from their captors. But very quickly here, phase two, the establishment of Israel. And this should move more quickly. First of all, the journey to Sinai, beginning in chapter 15:22, down through the end of 19. Now that they're safe from the previous captors of Egypt, Israel begins the journey to the place where God has chosen to speak to them and give them directions as his chosen nation. On the journey, on the way of the journey, the Lord provides for them food, water, and even an initial military victory that will give them some courage that the Lord is with them. I mean, they've been slaves for 400 years. They don't know how to fight. But he gives them an initial military victory, provides that to encourage them to say, the Lord is with us. And here's a professional army comes out to meet us, and we can beat them. That's good. That's an encouragement. They also provide leadership during this period of going through the journey to Mount Sinai, leadership for the people under Moses. The elders of Israel are established more firmly under Moses' leadership. Through this journey, they're brought to the foot of the mountain and preparations are made for God to speak to the people, which brings us second to the laws of Sinai. Israel has been in bondage and under the law of Egyptian pharaohs for now 4 centuries. They don't have their own laws. They don't have their own way of worship. Their way of life, work habits, views of marriage and family, understanding of slavery, diet, forms of worship, and their general understanding of right and wrong have been dominantly informed by an utterly pagan culture. That's all they've known for 400 years. Up to this point, of the history of the Bible, there have never been written commandments given to the people of God. They don't have a Bible to go to. All they have at this point, from what we know, is oral tradition. Because remember, Moses is the one who writes it down. There's no code of laws they've been given. Abraham has been told some specific things to do. Isaac has been, but there's no revealed law at this point. That's why there was sin abounding up till the giving of the law. And so at this point, God is going to give them a written set of laws, a law codes, to guide them. God intends for his people, at least at this stage of redemptive history, to look and act a certain way. Some of those ways will seem to us, as we read through this book, very unusual. Yet God has rescued them, and now, like a people have been rescued from slavery by a great king, they owe him everything. You want us to dress that way? No problem. We can't eat that. You know, some of the seafood stuff, we're not going to be able to eat. Well, that compared to slavery, that's okay. So all those laws that seem odd to us now, for them, should have been seen as gracious. Look, you're God. Look at everything you just did. What do we have to complain about? But sadly, they do again and again. God has rescued them, and they are called to enter into covenant with Him in voluntary obedience to the God who's been gracious to them. And this is where we kind of hit the brick wall, chapter 20. From chapter 20 to the end, the bulk of what is written was for the directing of the life of the nation of Israel, especially as they prepare to enter into a land as a special people, as the promises were made and fulfilled to Abraham. Which brings us, I've divided it essentially into three sections from 20 on to the end. First of all, in chapter 20, verses 1 through 20, he gives them what I believe is the heart of the covenant and the heart of the law. The heart of what has been called the moral requirements or the moral law that he gives to Israel. Now, it's been noted by some biblical scholars that the form of what is delivered here is similar to something called a suzerainty treaty. You had a suzerain, you had a king who rescued you or who captured you, and he agreed in a written document, in this treaty, he offers the people that he has conquered, I'm not going to wipe you out. Instead, here are the conditions of you being my people. Here are the conditions. If you keep these conditions, I will bless you. If you do not keep these conditions, I will destroy you. All right? So there's either blessing or cursing. And so I think it's a legitimate thing to see that that was something that was popular within the nations and the dealings of the nations with one another. Whether Moses had that exactly in mind, we don't know, of course, but it certainly seems similar to some of those treaties or treatises. Something to be noted about the Decalogue, what is known as the Ten Commandments or the Ten Words, that's Decalogue, Deca for ten, and log for, Logos, Greek, the word for words, the Ten Words or the Ten Commandments. Something to be noted is that they alone are spoken by the voice of God in the entire book of Exodus. God speaks directly in giving of the law only in the Ten Commandments. That is really significant. Not only is it the only thing spoken to the people by God Himself, everything else comes through Moses after that. They alone are spoken by the very voice of God. They alone are written by the finger of God on tablets of stone. Nothing else of the law is written on the tablets of stone, not by Moses. Moses didn't write the Ten Commandments. God did with His own finger write the Ten Commandments. They alone are written on the second set of tablets. When Moses comes down, they're worshiping the calf. He throws them down, demonstrating the breaking of the covenant. They've already blown it. God says to him, "You bring another set of stones, just like the previous ones you brought, and I again will write on them my law." So it's highlighted in that way. These Ten Commandments alone are put into the Ark of the Covenant. We read that in Deuteronomy 10 and verse 5. The Ark of the Covenant placed in the Holy of Holies. The rest of the law is written in what's called the Book of the Law. But the Ten Commandments clearly have a distinctive place within Israel. He alone spoke it. He alone wrote it with His own finger on tablets of stone. He put them in to the Ark of the Covenant. Or have Moses put them in to the Ark of the Covenant. I think it's short-sighted or even worse to say that there's no distinction between the Ten Commandments and the rest of the law as seen in the book of Exodus. They clearly play a more prominent role than do the other laws that are given to Israel. Now, these commandments are well known by us as Christians. I hope they're well known. They're usually divided into two sections, our duty to God, chapters 1 through 4, but also our duty to others, chapters 6 through 10. But as I thought about this, let me challenge that a little bit. I suggest that the fourth commandment is actually a transitional commandment. As you look, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5 through 10, It says, you will have no other gods before me. You shall not make idols and bow down to them. You shall not take my name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And then over here, obey your mother and father. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not commit adultery. Do not, already said lie. Do not covet. All of those. But there's something really important in the context of the Egyptian slavery and redemption that comes about here in the fourth commandment. And that is, you shall do no labor on it, you neither your manservant nor your maidservant. They have come out of 400 years of 7 days a week work. And he graciously says to them, you're not going to do that to your servants. And there are a lot of laws about the servants that we come to in the book of Exodus. It's not only this will be a holy Sabbath to the Lord, but also it is a gracious blessing. He said, because you yourselves were slaves in Egypt. And I've always thought, now wait a minute, that means that he redeemed them and it has something to do with redemption. But I question that now. This is the day you will let your servants off because you know what it's like to live without the blessing of a weekly rest rooted in creation. That's what's taking place, I think, here in the Decalogue, which brings us what I'll call the application of the law, chapter 20. If you look over in chapter 20, God speaks these Ten Commandments and the people are terrified. They are absolutely terrified and they go to Moses and they say, don't let God say anything else to us or we're going to die. And he says, okay. Moses becomes the mediator. At this point, the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue, is spoken directly to Israel. Israel is so convicted in the presence of God and of His requirements and of His commandments, they beg Him, do not... I mean, we pray the opposite, don't we? Lord, speak to us. They were praying, tell God not to speak to us or we're going to die. And there's something important about that, is that Moses becomes mediator. If we try to speak to God and experience God without Christ, we should fear the Word of God. And that's where we cry out, let not God in His justice and His wrath speak to us. We say to Jesus, you speak to us in that sense. He's the mediator of the new covenant. Moses is seen clearly as the mediator of this old covenant, the prophet of the old covenant. Now what follows, God agrees and He says, okay, you will be my mouthpiece. And probably He's speaking to Moses and then Moses to Aaron and then Aaron to them at this point, unless there's been some change up. What follows in this section are some specific applications of the general commands laid down in the Decalogue. They are not to be meant to be exhaustive, but they are instructions to help Moses and the leaders, the elders who have just been reconfirmed and established under Moses, of how to judge the people. He's giving them civil, moral law codes for the purpose of the legislation of the land. This is long before the kings, but this was God's law as king within the land. Now, there are many things that are particularly applicable to that culture, but we will still see them as principles that apply in a secondary way in the New Covenant Church. For example, Deuteronomy 25 and verse 4, we read, you shall not muzzle an ox. Well, this is actually not in Exodus. It's in Deuteronomy. It's an expansion of the law. But specifically in Deuteronomy, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. How many own oxes? Anybody here? Okay, well, that verse doesn't have anything to do with us then, does it? Oh, but the New Testament writers, particularly Paul, says that it does. Well, maybe he's talking about another kind of livestock. Maybe that applies in a secondary way to cows or to sheep or to pigs or something. Well, not pigs under that covenant, but something else. You shall not muzzle it while it's treading out the grain. Maybe that's what... The first application, of course, is to an ox while working should be allowed to be eating of the fruit of his labors. To deprive him of food while you take food from his labor would be unjust. God is concerned about the ox. But is he only concerned about the ox? It's interesting that in 1 Corinthians 9:9, 1 Timothy 5:18, Paul specifically applies this to the remuneration of ministers of the gospel, of the payment of ministers of the gospel. Is it ox that God's concerned about? No, those who labor by the gospel, will live by the gospel. 1 Timothy 5:18. So there is an application of the law that seems to us completely irrelevant, but the New Testament picks it up and uses it. There's a principle, there's a moral principle there that is worked out even under the New Covenant. As a result, the simple doing away with the Old Testament verses, because they don't seem directly to apply to our situation, at least should be challenged. Just say, well, that's Old Testament, it doesn't matter. The New Testament challenges us not to think that way, to think a little more, a little further about that. We begin to the work of applying the whole Word of God by the help of His Spirit. Now, I don't know how it applies. You don't boil a goat in its mother's milk. I don't know how that applies today. The Jews would say that has to do with mixing of meat and milk and kosher laws and that kind of thing. But there's something that's going on in those verses. And then letter C, the last section of the book of Exodus, the regulation of worship, chapter 25 through 40. After addressing primarily the civil laws of the application of the Ten Commandments, this section addresses the regulation of God's worship. Having come out of Egypt, being familiar with many false practices in their worship, God lays out in great detail for the first time in human history what He expects. At this point, you have individual families, like Abraham, building altars, or Jacob building altars. And you say, well, where did that come from? Well, it's this inclination of worship and altar building. But up to that point, there's no direction given. And now they're given plenty directions, and they're not for the household. They're for the nation, the representative of the entire nation. What we have here are the instructions of how the tabernacle is to be built, its dimensions, what furniture is to be placed in the tabernacle, such as the table of showbread, the lampstand, the altar of incense, the specific kind of altars that are to be on the outside and the inside of the tabernacle, the tent, what kind of offerings are to be made, the Sabbath, the establishment of the priesthood, what the priests are to wear, what kind of incense mixtures they're to have. That begins in Exodus and goes through Leviticus and Deuteronomy. All of that continues. Reading of all of this may be tedious to some of us, but it again roots us in a real-world setting, realizing that people really did make these things and use them in the worship of God. It tells us about the great care and artisanship that was put into God's worship. They didn't just say, well, it's just meat anywhere, it doesn't matter. At this point of God's revealing of Himself, there was meticulous work and labor and care for His house. It also tells us in this book that God sent His Spirit to give men like Bezalel wisdom and understanding to be excellent creators and artisans. It says He filled them with the Spirit of wisdom and understanding so that they would create these various things. Now, as a side note, it was just a few years ago when I was much more skeptical about the place of art in the life of Christians when I realized a stunning fact from the book of Exodus. It's clear in Exodus chapter 20 that God forbids the making of the image of anything above, anything underneath the earth, for the purpose of worship. That's clear. Nothing for the purpose of worship is to be created. Now, this is especially pertinent in light of the fact that Israel had come out of the idolatry of Egypt. They even built this calf. When Moses is up there for too long, they said, where is Moses? That horrible incident where Aaron creates his own creation myth. Where Moses comes down, sees them dancing and laughing and worshiping this calf. And Moses, what's going on here? And Aaron creates his own creation myth. Well, the people brought gold, I threw it in the fire, and out came this calf. That's a creation myth. It's an answer to how something came to be. Well, I just threw it in. He lies. It says he fashioned it earlier in that text. So that stuff's taking place. Well, in light of that, the fact that God says, you shall make no images to worship them, is especially important for them. However, one of the things that God commands, which stunned me, was that they would make images of angels and put them on the Ark of the Covenant and weave it into the tapestry. That they would make images of pomegranates and of olive branches And in the very artisanship and work of the various pieces of the tabernacle and later the temple, they were creating images of things above and things underneath. When it becomes clear, worship is out of the question of such images. But the very thing that we would take by way of application, God says don't create images of anything, no art, no angels. God commands them, and the high priest would confront the created angels as he came into the throne room of God. As he came through the veil, there on the top of the ark are golden angels with their wings spread out. Was he to worship them? Absolutely not. But the application we would make, you can't make images of anything like angels. We see God himself commands it. And that threw me for a big loop. Made me really start thinking some things. What God seems to forbid, he commands in another place, which means my application of that is not necessarily right. Now, the book ends with a description of the glory of God coming down in the presence of the tabernacle. We are told that when the glory of the Lord was with them, they stayed. When God's glory went up from the tabernacle, then they moved on. This certainly has a lesson for us. In our daily lives, what we desire is to know the glory and the presence of the Lord. His presence, His pleasure. And for that reason, we seek to follow Him and do as He commands and say, "Speak, Lord, wherever You go, we will follow." That we will do. Let me just read here the four major themes as we're past our time. First of all, we see again in this book God's great grace toward undeserving, and quite frankly, a grumpy and complaining bunch of people. Great, Moses, thanks. Well, that's not the first thing that happens. They complain about the manna. They complain, "You've just brought us out into the wilderness to kill us and our children." At one point they say, "It's better if we'd stayed in Egypt than come out here and die in the wilderness." You bunch of ingrates. But there's my heart. There's our heart. We so quickly get tired of the things that are good for us. Just plain manna. Week by week by week. And we are so quick to complain. What does God do? A couple of times He's about ready to destroy them. And the mediator steps up. He says, "For your own name's sake, don't kill them. Kill me rather than kill them." And He never takes Moses up on that offer. But that's what Jesus does. God says, "If my wrath is going to be enacted, I'm going to have to kill somebody. Because of justice and because of holiness." And Jesus steps up and says, "I'll do it. I'll kill me instead." And God says, "Okay." What He didn't allow Moses to do, He allowed His son to do. That's God's great grace. We see the Lord as the sovereign God over all, even the most powerful leaders and nations of the earth, even when they're calling out saying, "How long, O Lord?" In God's timing, He will act. And He will redeem. And He will demonstrate His glory. And He will demonstrate His power. And it may not be in our generation. It may not be in our children's generation. But we continue to cry out because God is the God in heavens and does whatever He wills in the army of heavens and among the hosts of the earth. Even a man like Pharaoh, He can bring to nothing in a moment. We should not fear. Number three, we see Moses as a type of Jesus Christ, the great prophet, intercessor, mediator before God for His people. And then fourth, we see the flaws of another great hero, Moses. After all that he saw, after all that he did, right at the end, he blew it. We read later, he gets angry. God had the right to get angry. Moses didn't. He strikes the rocks, "You stiff-necked and rebellious people." God says, "You're not entering into the promised land. You'll go to heaven. You'll be in my presence. But all of the blessing that you have been laboring for because of your sin is going to be withheld from you. There's a better place. There's a city whose foundations are made by God." We see even the greatest of the hero here in the book of Exodus himself is flawed. Which points us again to the perfection of Jesus Christ. And let's pray, please. Father, what great grace and mercy you displayed to Israel, and you've displayed to us through Christ. The next hour, help us to worship you in a way that is worthy of your holy name. In Jesus Christ we pray. Amen.